So it looks like we've got a couple of visitors with us. Welcome. We are in the last of the classes that I'm going to be teaching. And this year, our study has been really focused around, the Old Testament and what we can learn from the Old Testament. And, of course, the idea then is, you know, what things were written beforehand or written for our learning. And I was assigned the book of Genesis, so today we'll finish up with our last modern lesson from the book of Genesis. So I want you to take a minute to consider the life of Joseph. And, Joseph had a lot of good things going, and he had a lot of terrible things going, didn't he? If you remember, Joseph was the firstborn son of Jacob's favorite wife. And so because of that, that made him the favorite son. And Jacob, you would have thought Jacob would have known better, right? Because Jacob grew up in a family where his father had a favorite son and his mother had a favorite son, and it created all kinds of trouble. And you'd think he would have learned from that, but he didn't. And so Jacob had a favorite son, and it was Joseph. And Joseph got lots of benefits because he was the favorite son. He didn't have to go out into the fields with his brothers. He was given a special coat. It was very obvious that he was the favorite son. And as a result, Joseph was hated by his brothers. And you remember the story where Joseph went to see his brothers while they were in the field, and they planned to kill him, but instead they ultimately sold him as a slave. Through the course of time, he gets elevated into his master's house, in Potiphar's house, and then he's falsely accused, then thrown in prison, and forgotten about in prison, right? Remember, he was there for a while, and He told some folks, "Hey, remember me," and it was a really long time before they did. Then he eventually becomes second in command of Egypt, and his brothers ultimately come to him. Do you remember what Joseph said to his brothers after he revealed himself to them? What was their reaction? They were afraid, yeah, they were afraid. And do you remember what Joseph said to them? Let's look at Genesis chapter 50 and 20. Somebody, if you get there, let's read it. Genesis 50 and 20.
"But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as in this day to save many people alive."
All right. "As for you, you meant it evil, but God meant it for good." So this morning, this is going to be our last modern lesson from the book of Genesis. And it's the idea that all things work together for good for the righteous. That in the end, things are going to turn out okay. And Joseph recognized this, right? Joseph recognized that looking back on his life, yes, the people who put him into the positions that he were in, that his brothers who sold him into slavery, that they meant it for evil, but God had a hand in that. And God allowed that to happen for good. It was meant for good to bring about this moment, that moment where Joseph would save his family. So this idea that all things work together for good, that's not what Joseph said. That comes from where? Where does that come from? That's right. That comes from Romans 8:28. And so this idea that things are going to work out for the righteous is repeated in the New Testament. And so, again, just like our previous classes, we're not going to spend a bunch of time in the Old Testament, but that's the premise for it, right? The premise is that we can look at the life of Joseph and see that things were really terrible for Joseph, but yet in the end, it all worked out. And that's a biblical principle. It's something that's repeated in the New Testament, Romans chapter 8, verse 28. We know that all things work together for good for those who love the Lord, to those who are called according to His purpose. So we could go, I don't know, a dozen different directions on this. But thinking about the progression in Joseph's life, there were some pretty bad things that happened to Joseph. And yet it all worked out. God, too, allows us to be tested, right? Sometimes God puts us through some pretty rough things. And sometimes those testings can feel an awful lot like trials. I have a suspicion that we're going to study this same topic a couple of months down the road with whomever has the topic of Job, because that is the life of Job, right? Think about Job. And I don't want to steal their thunder, but let's look at the first two chapters of Job. In Job chapter 1, verses 8 through 12, we have this just picture of God and Satan having a conversation. We see nothing else like it in the Bible. So we'll pick up Job chapter 1, verses 8 through 12. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and all around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land. Now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So remember what happens at the end of chapter 1? What happens at the end of chapter 1 to Job? Everything is taken away. And by everything, we mean all of his possessions and all of his children. Right? He's left with his wife, who we find out later may not be quite the comforter that she could have been. But everything is taken away from Job. And what does the end of chapter 1 say? Yeah. In all of this, Job did not do wrong. So then, we see in Job chapter 2, a very similar situation, right? Where God says to Satan, "Hey, have you checked out my servant Job?" And in the end, what does Satan ask for? Because what was it that Satan didn't let, or what was it that God didn't let Satan do? Didn't let him touch him, right? So now, God allows Satan to harm him. And then, of course, then the rest of the book of Job follows. Have you ever wondered if God has conversations with Satan about you, like he had about Job? Like, it's almost like God is highlighting Job to Satan to say, "Hey, look at this guy. You could do anything to him and he's still going to serve me." Would you pass that test? I mean, if you were Job, would you pass that test? I mean, that would be pretty hard, wouldn't it? We think about what Job went through. I mean, he lost all of his physical possessions. He lost his children. And he lost his health.
But today, we've been promised that he won't put on us more than we can.
All right, we're going to get. Yeah, we are going to get to that for sure. That's right.
That just comes out.
Yeah, and actually, that'll be the next verse we look at. So if you want to turn ahead to 1 Corinthians 10:13, that's where we're headed. I don't know of any one of us who has suffered like Job to the magnitude that Job has suffered. Right? Job suffered everything; all of it was gone. But certainly some of us have suffered some of the same things that Job has suffered, right? Just in our own group, we've lost spouses to death. We've lost spouses to the world. We've lost children before they were born. We've lost children to the cares of the world. We've struggled with physical health. We've struggled with mental health. We could go on, but the problems that Job suffered, some of us have suffered some of those problems. And yet we're still here. And why is that? Well, it's because God is not going to allow us to be tested beyond what we can handle. So, Dwayne, you already spilled the beans, so why don't you read the verse for us? 1 Corinthians 10:13.
"No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, But with the temptation will also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it.
All right. Now, I know this verse is talking about temptation, right? And you might make a difference between temptation and trials of the world. But I think the same thing can apply, where God tells us He's not gonna allow us to be tempted beyond what we can handle. And I think that the same thing can be said about the testings of life. God's not gonna make life so hard on us that we can't handle it. So what does that tell you about Job? Job could handle a lot, couldn't he? Right? That's what it tells us.
Actually, that word in the Corinthians, that word temptation, means an experiment, or that leads to testing, trials. So really,
yeah,
it goes right along.
Okay, well, that's good.
And in Hebrews, we're told that God will help us.
Okay. And what passage are you thinking of there?
Hebrews 4 and 16.
All right. Hebrews 4:16. You want to read it for us?
There's therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in a time of need.
Good. Not a passage I had, so good. So I want to ask a question. Why? This is a question that probably other people have asked at various times. Why does God allow suffering in the world? I think there's a couple of answers, but why does God allow suffering?
Take one of the principles is out of weakness you are made strong.
Okay. So we'll start with that one. Let's see what are other reasons why God would allow suffering in the world? All right. So the idea of there's something better than here, that it's not permanent. Okay.
We know that the earth is the devil's territory, so to speak, and I don't know where God allows it. It's just here because it's not heaven.
Yeah. Well, let's address both of those, and then I've got one more thought for you. So let's start with to make us stronger. I was asking Emily about this last night. I'm sure I'm not going to get it perfectly right, but Paige and Nora and Reese are in the gifted program at NXA, and they have this thing where they talk about I always say don't cut the butterfly's wings, but that's not exactly what it is. But the principle is that if you ever see a butterfly coming out of its chrysalis or a moth coming out of its cocoon, you're not supposed to help it. Because what happens if you help the butterfly?
It dies.
And why does it die? Because its wings don't work, right? There's something about the struggle of getting out of the cocoon that strengthens the wings of the butterfly and the moth, that allows it to fly. And if you help, then it's not going to succeed. It will ultimately die. And gifted program, I mean, their intention is to make the kids struggle so that they can learn, right? Well, I think that Bob was saying that, and I think that's true in life too, that God gives us struggles so that we can become stronger, just like the butterfly, right? God sends us challenges so that we can learn from them. And that's the whole point of Hebrews chapter 12. So we're going to actually spend a little bit of time in Hebrews now and then again in a minute. But let's start with Hebrews chapter 12. Now, Hebrews chapter 12 follows chapter 11. And what's chapter 11 about? It's the Hall of Fame of Faith. And we're going to come back to Hebrews chapter 11. So keep that in the back of your mind. All of these people who had faith. And then the next chapter is chapter 12. So Hebrews 12, let's look. It's a little bit of a lengthy passage, but let's look at verses 3 through 11. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. For you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My sons, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by Him. For whom the Lord loves, He chastens, and scourges every son whom He receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For indeed, for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but He for our profit, that we may be partakers of His holiness. Now no chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruits of righteousness for those who were trained by it. So the writer of Hebrews makes this point to say that, well, what's the comparison that the writer of Hebrews is making?
Well,
yeah, a physical father to their children. They discipline, right? You've been around children who have not been disciplined by their parents. That usually doesn't go over very well, right? But the writer of Hebrews says, we have human parents who discipline us, and we pay them respect. So why should we be surprised when God disciplines us? But it's not just discipline there, right? We can think about the trials that God allows us to go through and make the same case, right? God allows us to be tempted, to be tried, to be tested, so that we can be made stronger. All right, so the other comment... Oh, Maverick?
And a great example of that is Job.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think before you guys came in, we had talked about Job. All right, so the other example that was made or that was said was so that we know that this world is only temporary. And I think that's a great point too. Imagine what you would think of the world if it was perfect and without suffering. I mean, think about that. Would you want to leave? That's right. You wouldn't want to leave. You wouldn't know that there's something better. You wouldn't have any hope. All right, so now let's backtrack and let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. Now we think about Hebrews 11 as the Hall of Fame of faith, right? But what's really interesting is that Hebrews 11 mentions a few people by name, and then at the end of the chapter, it's a bunch of sort of etc., right? We'd say, you know, it's Adam, Abraham, Moses, etc., right? So I want to read the etc. part. And I want you to think about it in context of this idea of that our suffering in this world reminds us that the world is temporary. So Hebrews 11, we're going to read 32 through 40. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violent fires, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to fight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Now, I want you to focus on the rest of this. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonments. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Do you see how that passage, it's not really talking about this idea that God allows us to go through suffering so that we know that that there's something better, but it's sort of there, right? You can see that the listing at the end of Hebrews 11 that talks about all the other people who the writer just doesn't have time to mention talks about how some got they were saved from all of these things, right? They were saved from the mouth of lions. They were saved out of the edge of the sword. But then there were some who didn't, right? There were some who suffered a lot.
And then in 12, it's talking to those who have not yet resisted unto death. But here, it's talking about those that resisted, but they were killed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, in my notes, I had these flipped around. I probably should have kept it that way. But the point here is that all of these folks suffered, but they didn't receive the promise. And in their suffering, they did not accept deliverance. Well, why did they not accept deliverance? Because there was something better. And so I think the suffering of the world helps us to understand that there is something better. I do think there's one other thing that is a reason why there is suffering in the world, and maybe more specifically, a reason why us individually might suffer. And that's found in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. If you know Ecclesiastes 9, you know exactly what I'm going to tell you, and that is that sometimes it's just chance, right? Sometimes it's just chance. Ecclesiastes 9:11, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so are the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. Sometimes we go through bad things just by chance. And it's not that God had a hand in it. I mean, God allowed it to happen, and so in that way, He had a hand in it, right? But sometimes we go through things by chance.
I got a passage that I think goes with this. Isaiah 57, 1 and 2 says, the righteous perishes, and no man takes it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from evil. He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. So, there is some really bad things that happen, but look what we reap in the end.
Yeah, good point. All right, at the end of Hebrews chapter 12, that section that we read, verse 11, says, now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. It's a funny way to say things, right? But have you ever thought about your sufferings being joyful? Well, strangely, it seems as though we're supposed to rejoice in our trials. So in James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Well, that seems strange. Well, what's the rest of that say? Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, and let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect, complete, lacking nothing. Right? So, this idea of rejoicing in trial. Have you ever done that? You ever rejoiced in trial, Brenda?
Yeah. You think, I am grateful that God allowed me to go through that. I didn't enjoy it at the time, but I think it's when you look back.
Yeah, and actually that's the point that the writer of Hebrews is making there in Hebrews 12:11. No chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Right? That's the whole point of that verse, is that, yeah, in that moment, it is not joyful, but when you make it through and you realize God was with you, and then that's when it's joyful. And you'll be stronger for the next one. Absolutely, that's right. One other passage on that's Romans chapter 5, verses 3 through 5. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulation, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Now hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit who was given to us. Is that interesting? Both of those passages, right? James and Romans, written by two different people, both tell us the same thing, right? That trials produce what? It's the same thing. Patience, right? Perseverance, patience, it's the same thing. But Paul in Romans goes on to say that our patience produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint. Maverick? Oh, I thought you were... Yeah, I thought you had a comment. Okay, all right. There are probably no other perfect examples of this idea of having joy in trials than the apostles. So we're studying Acts on Wednesday nights, and we just got done studying Acts chapter 5 a couple of weeks ago, but I want to take you back there. Remember in Acts chapter 5, all the apostles are thrown in prison, and they showed up before the council. The council told them, hey, you better stop preaching. And I think they were actually beaten here, but maybe I ought to check that before I tell you that they were beaten. Okay, they were beaten in verse 40. Okay, well, good. Because it's verse 41 that I want to focus on. Verse 41 says, and they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. And maybe more so than some of the other apostles, Paul details for us his sufferings. And so in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 24 through 28, Paul lays out for us all of the things that have happened to him. Somebody want to read that for us? 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 24 through 28.
From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils of the wilderness, and in perils of the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fasting often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all of the churches.
So when did all of this happen to Paul? Did all of this happen before his conversion? No. All of this happened after Paul's conversion. And Paul, in lots of ways, is real similar to Job. I don't know. I mean, we don't know. But maybe God had a very similar conversation with Satan about Paul in the same way that he had about Job. Hey, see my servant Paul? And so, look at all of these terrible things that happened to Paul. And what does Paul think of those things? Well, he doesn't tell us here in 2 Corinthians, but he tells us in another place. So, James, since you read this one, why don't you go to Philippians chapter 1 and verse 12. Because Paul tells us what he thinks about all of these terrible things that happened to him.
But I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel.
I don't know that I'd ever put those two things together, right? I mean, I know Paul talked about all the terrible things that happened to him. Well, I'm not sure I paid a lot of attention to that passage there in Philippians 1 and 12. All of those things, Paul said, they happened to me. Why?
To the furtherance of the gospel.
That's like Paul saying, all things work together for God's plan, right? It was God's plan that all of these terrible things happened because it was for the furtherance of the gospel. Think about just one thing related to Paul. What happened because Paul was in chains? Right? Because Paul was in prison, what happened? Okay. I wasn't thinking that, but all right.
There were other people that were kind of competing against Paul, maybe kind of like some of them. They preached the gospel maybe for the wrong reason, but they did preach the gospel.
Yeah, there were people who were emboldened because of Paul's chains. I'm not sure it was exactly that, but that's what we're told, is that they were emboldened because of his chains. So even that thing, that one thing that was like, Paul's in prison. What good could come of that? And yet he spoke, preached to the people who were taking care of him or watching over him, but also people were emboldened. So why are we supposed to rejoice in our trials? Yeah, good. Good. I didn't have that one. That's a good, goes right along with it. Well, we're supposed to rejoice in trials because of what Romans 8:28 tells us, right? Because in the end, all things are going to work out for God's for good. Gordon.
Paul's description of there, that was persecution. That one was, his trials were because he was trying to further Christ. And when we, in the Bible also tells us, that living like Christ and suffering like Christ is glory to God. And so that's another reason we can do this, because we bring glory to God when we suffer for Christ and suffer like Christ.
Yeah, good point. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1. Because I think 1 Peter 1 makes a point that I think is good for us to realize. Verses 6 through 9. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen, seen you love. Though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your soul. When God tells us in Romans 8:28 that all things will work together for good, one of our other modern lessons is that God's time is not our time, right? That when God makes a promise, it might take thousands of years for God to fulfill that promise, but he will fulfill it. So God tells us all things will work together for good. What God doesn't say is that that's going to happen in our lifetime. Right? He doesn't say that that's going to happen here on earth. And I think 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through 8 makes that point to us, that you're going to be going through various trials, and the thing that you can hang on to is that in the end, even if you're not saved from those trials here, what's going to happen? The salvation of your soul. And in the end, that's going to be good, isn't it? That
Jesus also was pretty plain about it, that all people who are going to be a faithful follower of his will suffer persecution.
Yeah, that's right. Now, are we all going to be beaten with 40 stripes? No, but yeah, it will be. And I don't want to be a downer, but I think we could all think about times in our lives that we've been persecuted because of being a Christian. And I don't know, it very well may get worse before the Lord comes. I think that's what I think the Bible tells us that it will.
Some of the foreign countries are being beheaded.
Sure. Yeah, we do have it much easier here than some of our Christian brethren in other nations, for sure. So, James.
You probably already touched on this, but I think also our trials, not necessarily persecution, but our trials, help us to remember our place and turn to him for help.
Oh.
Just under subjection of him, because, when everything's going good, it's easier for us to forget that we need help.
Oh, yeah. So, all right, that makes me think. No, that was not one of the thoughts that I had, but that's an excellent point, right? Let's go to Ecclesiastes. Psalms. Proverbs. Sorry. My brain's thinking where this is. Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30, verses 7 through 9. Two things I request of you, deprive me not before I die, remove falsehoods and lies from me, give me neither poverty nor riches, feed me the allotted food to me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. All right, so it's the comment about the rich person, right? That I'm full and deny you, right? So maybe, I think what you're saying is, God gives us sufferings so that we can turn to Him, so that we recognize that we need Him. That's a great point. I think that's what the Proverbs is telling us too. Good. All right. I want to go back to Genesis chapter 50 and 20, the verse that we started with. Joseph says, "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." So, what Joseph is saying is that God had a hand in his life. God intervened. We might call that divine intervention, right? And certainly God is involved, but how much is God involved? And we just don't have time to talk about this because we ran out of time, but you know, it's maybe a whole nother lesson, but you know, you've been around folks who something happens and they'll say, "Well, that was God's will." I've got a nurse who things worked out the way she was expecting it, and she likes to call it. She says that was a God thing. Well, how much does God intervene in our lives? Well, certainly some, right? Certainly some. We could look at lots of passages. Matthew chapter 6, where we're told that if you seek the kingdom of God first, all these other things will be added to you. It was all the worries that people had, right? So if you do the right thing, it's going to be taken care of. 1 John chapter 5, verse 14. Now this is the confidence that we have in Him. If we ask anything according to His will, He hears us. By implication, that it's going to be taken care of. James chapter 1, verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives all liberally without reproach, and it will be given to you. So, you know, does God intervene in our lives? Yeah, certainly. But does God control our lives? No. There's a balance. There's a balance between divine intervention and our own free will. All right. The last thing I want to bring up is that passage that we sort of framed all of this around, Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for good, that those who love God and those who are called according to His purpose. And why do we know that all things will work out for good? Well, skip down a couple of verses to verse 31. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? That's right. If you're serving God, if God is on your side, He's more powerful than anything that could come your way. And so He's going to take care of you. All right, I've enjoyed having this study. I look forward to... I don't know who is next. Eric is next. All right, well, I look forward to Eric's lesson. So we'll take a short break.